last time she was
here. Because you're not still eating those Wahoo cookies that look Wahoo so delicious. Wahoo cookies? Those nasty M&M cookies that you had last time.
Oh, yeah. Those got taken care of.
Like, into the trash, I hope, and not into your stomach.
And I feel like you meant to eat them all.
Let's talk about something else.
That's shameful. Like...
The following is a Mediocre Movie Club production.
Welcome back to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. We are here tonight to continue our discussion of the second season of Stranger Things on Netflix. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Ashley Keller.
Hey.
Bobby Schmidt.
Hello.
And superfan Megan.
Still on the sidelines.
Yep, that is correct. And will likely continue to be.
But so. Getting far more airtime than people in the club, so it's all right.
Certainly true. She's one of our patrons now, I feel like. I feel like we have to upgrade from superfan. Can we come up with a better adjective?
Oh, man. I would love a new adjective.
I mean, I'm open to suggestions.
But not club member.
No.
Never club member. I think that's really important.
I mean, bridesmaid, perhaps?
always a bridesmaid, never a club member.
Yes, unlike famous bride Sean Riley or Brian Hartman. Beautiful, beautiful brides. But alas, Megan, just a bridesmaid.
Sad, so, but you know, somebody has to hold their dress while they pee.
God, is that the main requirement of bridesmaids?
Number one.
It's one of them. Yeah, for sure.
To keep the rims of dresses urine free.
Yeah, the bigger the dress, the more taxing the job.
I'm going to keep that in mind the next time I see someone get really excited about accepting a bridesmaid invitation.
Yeah, just know they're probably about to have their own Trump-esque golden shower situation coming their way.
Yeah, like you're going to spend a lot more time in the bathroom than you think you're going to with this with this acceptance. And you're going to hear what it sounds like for a bride to pee on her wedding day. So thank you, question mark. Anyways, we're here tonight to discuss the fourth, fifth, and sixth episodes of the second season of Stranger Things, entitled Will the Wise, Dig Dug, and The Spy. And I'm just going to come out and say that I retract my reticence about the first three episodes from last week, because these three episodes are as good as Stranger Things has ever been.
I had a feeling you would say that. Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that these are the three standouts of the entire series for me, probably. It really felt like it hit a stride in almost all of the storylines, these three episodes.
Yeah, even the teenagers are inoffensive. We'll talk about why perhaps that is. And let's not pretend either that I'm not going to complain about a few things here and there, because of course I am.
We must.
There are absolutely still things to complain about. But as far as the pro column against the con column for this week, the pro is vastly outnumbering in the cons. I feel like this was more of a traditional television or TV season, in that there was that slow buildup. And we talked about this last week, where some of that pacing from the first season was surely to draw viewers in, whereas this season they have more luxury to build their arcs and to build the plot up. And it was just tremendously effective in many different ways. And I'm going to go ahead and say that the main reason for that is Will and the actor playing him, Noah, whatever his last name is, Schnapp or Schnapp or something. He's great. I think he's the best part of the show.
I don't know if I agree that he's the best part of the show, but I was definitely pleasantly surprised by him, because I think that I had questions. I mean, we just didn't see him act at all last season. And then I feel like he came out the gate this season and pulled very far ahead of all of his counterparts, who are also very, very good actors. So to be a standout in this crowd of child actors, I think is incredibly impressive. And he just knocks it out of the park this season. It's crazy.
I think the show is asking the most from him,
mm-hmm,
as far as intensity and as far as range. And I think he's got no problem with it.
They also asked the least from him last season.
Certainly true. Yeah, they asked him to do was just to hold still while Hopper pulled a snake out of his mouth, more or less.
Yeah.
And he was great at that. He coughed convincingly afterwards, but he was just sidelined. And he's making up for lost time this year.
Much like me when I get my new title in the group. It's fine, guys.
I mean, we'll never know. We'll never know. That might be the case, but I mean, maybe one day we'll find out. Maybe you watch one of the movies from this trio or the next trio, and you just anything about
which
it.
Which would be more than most of us have done.
Yeah. Ugh. That's fine. In the new...
Charity said she doesn't like a movie.
I'm not a big fan of movies, guys. We've talked about this. I mean,
but that's all right, because it's not a requirement to be in the club.
At the Landmark Arts... or at the Landmark Midtown Art Cinema in Atlanta, an excellent theater. If they want to sponsor our podcast with some tasty gift certificates, I'm sure they listen. They're always playing retrospectives, and at this moment right now, they're doing like a Revenge of the Dish Best Served Cold retrospective, and Kill Bill, the entire two movies, is going to be one of them. And Megan, I don't like movies, Norfleet is going to sit in that theater with me next week for 4.5 hours and watch two of the greatest movies ever made. So I don't really believe you.
But that's true. I like those
movies. You don't like movies. You like some
movies. That's a good point. Okay, that's a good point. I love a Tarantino. I love a Wes Anderson.
Have we done a Wes Anderson, Bobby?
I mean, it would have been me who picked it, right?
Yeah, I would think so.
I don't remember picking one.
We are in our fifth season. It's hard to remember.
I would assume Brian vetoed it if I did. So
certainly possible. I feel like we have. If we haven't, we've done things reminiscent of Wes Anderson.
Yeah. If you guys do a Wes Anderson, I don't even need to watch it. I can give you a review right now. Like.
Okay. Yeah. And that would be enough.
No watching necessary.
They're still not going to let her in. Like, why lead her along?
We might. Who knows?
I thought that's the
requirement.
I thought that Kissel, like Saddam Hussein, this shit was dictator now.
He didn't change that rule yet.
I've done nothing with the membership rules. You can't take power all at once. You take it slowly and then a little more and a little more and a little more. It's the frog in the pot. I'm turning the heat up gradually. Okay. I've taken away the group's choices as far as movies go, and eventually I'll take away the group's choices as far as who's in the group. But I've said too much.
And then the membership will be mine.
Maybe.
Or just him.
Or Kissel's going to flip the script on me and he's going to be like, you know what, Megan, I just don't think you're MMC material. I'm sorry.
Your Wes Anderson review lacked depth, and we require more.
At least
so,
I do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been enough in plenty of recent years. So if Will is getting greater screen time, it's coming at the expense of Mike, who has had basically nothing to do in these first six episodes, going back to the premiere last week. He's just been sullen, and he was given a scene with Max that allowed Eleven to run away angry. But he's just been a sidekick. He's not driving the plot himself, which is, I mean, I feel like he's the biggest, or he has the most extensive resume of the four of them, with it specifically. Like, he's in one of the biggest movies of the year, potentially the best part of the biggest movie, one of the biggest movies of the year, It Talk Again. But yeah, he's just hanging by Will's bedside for most of these three episodes, or hanging out in the cabin, not really contributing, just there for color, more or less. A little disappointing, but we'll see what happens in these final three, because Mike's a good character, Finn Wolfhard's a good actor. So Will, and the increased role that the actor is taking in the show, is one part of it. Another part of why I love this three episodes so much is that the show is actually about something now, beyond there were good movies. There were good pop movies from the 80s that we liked. Like, when Will is describing what it was like for the smoke monster to whatever it did with him, he's talking about a molestation. Like, he's using molestation words. He felt it everywhere. And combined with what he talked about last year, or what he went through last year, like, the show is about reactions to trauma and getting through it, not only with Will, but also with Eleven, especially in these three episodes, where you bring her mom into it, and Nancy with how she feels culpable about Barb, let us never speak her name again, and Hopper with his dead kid and with that loss and how he's substituted Eleven in for it. It's consistent, like, through the episode and through these various storylines, and I do not feel that was the case at all last year. Like, just the bar for TV is higher in recent years. Like, shows can't just be a series of events as I feel like Game of Thrones is becoming. Like, they have to be about something because the bar has been raised. And, like, Stranger Things is making a leap, like a critical leap, in the middle part of the season. And I really hope they're able to keep it up.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a lot more, like, thematic consistency between all of the characters this season than there ever was last season. Like, there were definitely plots last season where you could lift the entire plot out of the show and it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't be connected in any way at all. And I think this season they're doing a much better job. And I mean, I'm sure we're going to talk about like the integration of the teenagers and the kids, but even just like with what they're going through, it all feels much more integrated and cohesive this season than it did last season.
Yes. And just thematic consistency, just that there is a theme, period. Like, I feel like the mystery just consumed too much of the show last year to where that was all there was room for. And the season's a little longer now. They don't have to do as many introductions. Now there's more room for something like this theme of what it's like to live with something horrible that has happened to you. So much appreciated. It feels like a real show and not just a series of homages now. So something we talked about last week, but regrettably it got cut due to some shoddy internet on my part. Apologies.
Thanks, Shane. Blame Shane.
Yes, I completely. I blame Shane and AT&T. We talked about Eleven and Hopper last week and just the very strange pacing that existed in those first three episodes and the utility of all their flashbacks. I don't understand what the point of that was. I feel like there were better ways to demonstrate what Eleven has been up to in the year that has gone by between seasons.
I don't think she hasn't been up to much, so I just don't feel the need to even show it.
But I mean,
why show?
It was completely obvious.
Yeah,
where she ended up and how she got there.
Yeah, we're not learning anything from the flashbacks. It's just how they got to know each other. I feel like the easy alternative is that she is kind of fending for herself longer than she was, which was what, a day, if that. Because
out in the wild.
Why? I mean, and that brings us back to the first season. Like, why do they even need her to disappear if she was immediately going to be found?
But like, was it a day? Because didn't
yeah, I feel like it was longer than a day.
Because when they're mentioned of like multiple boxes of waffles or something, I found the boxes of waffles or something. I don't remember.
And I feel like the seasons change in the flashbacks. Like, it goes from being fall to being winter.
Oh yeah, like as far as the show is concerned, she's been with Hopper since there was snow on the ground all the way around to October again.
Are you talking about how long she was with Hopper?
No.
She was in the woods for
the period of time from when she disappears after whatevering the Demogorgon she wakes up in the Upside Down. She sticks her hand through that wall vagina, and then she's out in the world again, and she's immediately found. In the wood. No, she goes to Mike's house while they're debriefing the evening of, like, after they're back at the house talking about this crazy thing that just happened and you can't talk about it anymore. And then she's out in the woods, and then Hopper finds her. There might be more time between in the woods and when Hopper finds her, but like, that's what I'm unclear about.
Yeah, there's at least a couple months, I would think, because it goes from fall in October, or I guess early November, to at least winter in...
I mean, there can't be snow on the ground in Indiana in early November.
Yeah, but, I mean, the TV isn't going to show that, right? I mean, it's kind of a clear one season to another, I would imagine.
I mean, isn't that more interesting than her being stuck in a cabin, like, and doing a cleaning montage? Like, how did Eleven actually survive in, like, a dress in the woods in winter?
She took squirrels and flung them at people.
I mean, I feel like that's day one. What was she doing on, like, day 20? Like, eventually, she's got to find some shelter. Eventually, she's got to, like, make this shit work for herself. That's it. That I just would have preferred to see that. And just her getting more confident on her complete lonesome instead of this situation with her and Hopper where she's on house arrest. And I mean, just the idea that she's been there for like 200 plus days and we're just now seeing her get cabin fever doesn't strike me as true.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, she also didn't understand or know a lot of things. So, I mean, there's the aspect of Hopper taking her in and her actually genuinely wanting to learn from him and caring that he's taken her in. But yeah, I think
something. Yeah, as we said last week, she doesn't know words.
Right. Something probably would have exploded quicker than it did.
Yeah. And
I mean, I would say just by virtue of her being an 11-year-old girl, like, or however old they're supposed to be, 13. I mean, she would definitely get antsy. And like, if she wanted to see Mike, like, kids are like that. If she wanted to see Mike and she had the abilities that she had, like, she would have seen him on day three if she had wanted to see him as badly as they're trying to make it seem.
Yes, I 100% agree. It's all just a stall. I feel like they just really wanted to get back to Halloween. Like, there's no reason this season can't have taken place a month after the first season. Like, the first four seasons of Breaking Bad take place over, like, 8 months. And
really?
Yeah, there's a crazy amount of events that happened in between there. But it's over a very short period of time.
That's true, because that baby, I guess yep. That's your
yes.
Your-
I mean, I guess they had to get to the new school year for new students. They wanted the whole, spooky Halloween theme. But yeah, it was
They wanted it to be Halloween so that they could put it out during Halloween.
Wanted the release date to coincide with what was going on in the show.
I feel like it all just comes back to those Ghostbusters costumes. They have to find a way to put it in Ghostbusters costumes. They had, like, the second season of Stranger Things started with the Winston Zeddemore conversation. And then worked backwards. They just filled in all the details, starting like, this is what we have to have. And then
like the costume person just really wanted to make some miniature Ghostbuster thing, so they had to like make it work.
I spent a year sewing these together. I put this patch on myself, and then the Duffers are like, that costs $30 at max. But they're like, no, I work so hard. The costume designer wouldn't let it go, and here we are.
And it's like. And then, sorry, 11, you just spent a year in a cabin, so.
Yes, this is what our lives have been like with this costume designer. Into the second three episodes with Hopper and 11, it just continues their weird dynamic. Like, they have a domestic dispute more than, like, a parental fight, I feel, where there's just a lot of broken glass and TVs are destroyed. And Hopper leaves a teary apology on an answering machine. It's just weird. It's not coming across like I think the show wants it to come across. I think it all makes sense with Hopper, where he is recreating this relationship with his dead daughter. But it makes him a really unlikable character, even with the apology.
No, well, the apology was just out of fear and self-loathing after what happened.
Yeah.
I don't think it was, like, genuine.
Yeah, I mean, like, what if she was there listening to it and everything's fine? Is she all of a sudden allowed to go out? Probably not. Like, this was a way for him to get back to the status quo instead of letting 11 do what she wants.
Do you really think that this is in character with him, though? Because I didn't think that I didn't recognize this aspect of his character between last season and this season. And I feel like the fact that he did lose a daughter would make him more empathetic towards Elle. Rather than, like, this harsh. I don't know. This fight scene with them was so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I hated every fucking moment of it. I thought it was just so extra. And again, like, I've been a 13-year-old girl who got in fights with her dad. And, like, never in a million years. Like, never in a million years is that a realistic fight for a father-daughter. Which is the dynamic I think they're trying to portray here. Like, that is not realistic at all. Like, he is supposed to be the adult in the room. And like it felt like he was the one that was throwing the temper tantrum, not vice versa. I hated it. It was so dumb.
Being thoroughly able to like physically dominate this grown man, if she so chose, I feel like 13-year-old Megan, if she could like throw, if she's in a screaming fight with her dad and she has the power to throw him down the stairs with a flick of her head, I don't know, maybe you consider it at least.
What?
Just like in the heat of the moment. I feel like anybody would.
Why I'm not allowed in the club, because Kissel secretly thinks I'm a monster who wants to perform patricide, apparently.
I think you're an in-and-out plagiarist with your puddle stuff from last week.
Oh, you can fuck right off with that, because I came up with that shit.
I think every 13-year-old is mildly homicidal.
But I mean, we see Elle act out when she tosses the book back towards him and whatnot, and so I mean, it's there. I just don't think Elle. I don't think she would go to that level, considering doing more to him.
And that also would come from being brainwashed, which she essentially was for the first however many years of her life, right? I mean, it's like the kind of Stockholm syndrome. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
The kind of thing, like, her whole life has been about the fact that she has had this domineering, like, cruel male influence in her life. And, like, she has just always had to follow that. So I don't know. Again, I don't necessarily have an issue with the way that she reacted to that situation, but I do have an issue with the way that he reacted to that situation and, like, how over the top it felt on his part. And again, it got beyond frustration, I can understand and, like, kind of get with him, because if what he is actually trying to do at the end of the day is just keep her safe and she keeps doing things to put herself in danger in his mind, like, I understand getting frustrated with her and I understand trying to lay down the law with her. But what I don't understand is him just, like, almost starting to get, like, mean girls, like, cruel to her for no reason. And I just didn't think that that made sense with him or his character, or, like, if that was really the way he was, why even take her in the first place? You know,
a couple things on that, like, to further add to Hopper's, to the danger that he is putting himself in by screaming at this little girl. She has killed guards before when she's angry.
Right.
And, I don't know, probably. And then she was praised for that by her handler at how impressive she was. And I mean, like, what do we really know about Hopper from the first season? We know that he likes to punch a lot of people in the face when they're standing in his way. Like, he's not a big softy, even with the dead kid. Like, I guess you could say, like, in that context, he was, like, trying to find a lost little boy who everyone was telling him was dead when he was obviously not. But he punched a lot of people in the face last year. He's kind of brutish.
Yeah, but the one aspect of his life that he wasn't like that was with his daughter. Like, so when you go, like, back to the flashbacks of him with his kid, like, but I think the whole point of the reason as to why he's brutish and why he's rough around the edges is because he lost his daughter. So now that he has, like, that daughter figure back, like, you would think that some of that would melt away and it would go back to kind of the version of him that you were seeing in those flashbacks.
Yeah.
Not
there's
bring
definitely
out
something
the,
to that. Yeah.
And question. I think she recognized him as more than just a brutish character. Like, he still did take her in, and there were obviously moments where he cared for her and taught her things and took the time. So I don't think she would treat him or act as if he's, like, one of the guards or someone who's nothing but violent and dangerous. And I think that's, like, when she compared him to Papa, like, I don't know. And like you said, he was kind of acting like that, and that's why it felt so out of character.
Yeah. He's consistent with what I said the theme, what I interpret the theme of the season to be, which is, like, dealing with trauma, dealing with violation to your, like, personal space, to your body. He's got that trauma in his past, no question, but he's just, like, the least compelling example of it, I think, of the several characters who are living that, who are going through that, one of which is Eleven. I mean, Hopper's doing his investigating in these three episodes, and he doesn't have any sense that Eleven broke out pretty quickly from her grounding. And she's off on a mission to find her mom now that she thinks Mike has replaced her in the group, in the squad or the party or whatever they call themselves. And she succeeds in finding her mom. It's actually really easy.
Very, very quick.
Very easy. Like, in the span of a period between episodes, which I want to say is a few hours, because episodes are – everything's pretty compressed this season, which is totally fine. These are also scenes that really work. Thanks in large part to the actors. Thanks in large part to what's being conveyed. Thanks a lot to the direction by, like, serious director Andrew Stanton, who did WALL-E and I think Finding Nemo. Yeah, just he's a great. I thought the flashback was great. I thought it was consistent with what we expect of the bad guys in the show. I thought it was really affecting.
Yeah, the only thing I wish had happened in those scenes is I really wish that the mom had come out of her trance a little bit, maybe when Elle showed up. Like, there was something about that connection there that would bring her back from the edge. But I just don't know how realistic, you know, that is in that type of situation if she's basically been lobotomized at that point, you know.
Thinking that was what they were going towards, Megan, that they were going to have her kind of wake up or acknowledge Elle's presence or something. I don't know. I would have liked a little bit of interaction between the two of them more than what we got.
I think that's in keeping with the theme of that this it doesn't just go away. Like one good moment isn't gonna solve everything. Like Will was rescued, but his struggle continues. Like it's not it sticks with him. It stays with him. He can't get rid of it. It's a part of him now. And I think the same thing is true with Elle's mother and with Elle herself. So in a lighter corner of the world, Dustin's cat is dead.
Run, cover your ears. My cat's sitting right next to me and he looks horrified.
Has he got a little earbud popped into his ear? Like can he hear what we're saying, or just the very mention of a dead cat anywhere in the world
piques his interest?
What's left now of his tail sparks up.
That's funny because Dawson perked right up at the mention of a dead cat. So.
No, Ron, don't listen to them. I would never let
animals on this week's episode of MC Podcast, a fun new segment that we're going to incorporate into our musings.
My fish.
Our musings. Fucking nailed it.
Megan, you're in.
Listen, that was for one thing. That was all it took. Dad jokes.
Dad jokes
that only land about half the time.
So, Dart ate the cat.
He did do that.
He is the new Barb. Let us never speak of either of them ever again. There's gonna be a segment next season where there are two like sad cat. There are two like sad cats walking around, and Dustin looks at them and like does a Charlie Brown like slow walk forward with his head down after, because that's more or less the level that our parents are operating on.
Ate him real good.
It's a giant Demogorgon, surprising no one. Dustin was just way too stupid. We talked about this last week. Way too stupid to be a character that exists in the world, in this specific world, in those first three episodes. But I think he recovers admirably here and turning pretty quickly against Dart, and correctly so, because he did eat his cat. He had a bear in the backyard. Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like justifiably, him and his mom have a very affectionate, close relationship. And it's pretty obvious that the mom loves the cat a lot more than Dustin does. So I feel like his turning against Dart in that quickly is totally fine.
No, I mean, I kind of expected it quicker, though. Like, when they were in the school and Dart, like, screeched at all of them with its face open or whatever and then ran out of the room. It seemed like
I mean, cats hiss at you and you don't, like, smack them with a shovel after.
Yeah, but they don't remind me of a Demogorgon that I fought a year ago.
How does Dustin make it up? He enlists Steve Harrington into his quest to go track Dart down. Could be because Dart escaped into the forest here or there. This is a stroke of genius on the show. I think this is often a thing that happens with TV series where they introduce characters and they're within their own little groups. And comedies do this especially well, where they just have to mix people up after a certain point because they've said as much as they can say to the characters that they were introduced with. But they have said essentially nothing to characters in different groups. Characters like, for example, Dustin representing the kids and Steve Harrington representing the terrible teenagers. This immediately improves Steve Harrington as a character. I mean, there is some of Dustin admiring him, but it's more Steve going down to Dustin's level, which I think is so much the better choice. That's
so good.
I'm so glad the show made it.
Like, I mean, it really is. Some of the best dialogue of the entire season is between these two characters who, and it makes Steve like lovable, which was not a thing that was ever happening before.
Is this why people like him?
Yeah. This is why people like him. Yeah.
That can't be it.
It is. It is.
You're not a girl.
I get that. Yeah.
Bobby's the outlier on this
one. He gives such shitty advice too.
I think, yeah. Well, I mean, his advice is so limited to this tiny Indiana town. Yeah. He's been totally outclassed by a piece of shit from the town of California. So how much of a hold did he have on the social structure of Hawkins anyways?
But let's not forget, like, what kind of advice a 17-year-old would have anyway. Like, it's not like teenagers are, you know, have some kind of insight into life that's so much more advanced or complex than what a 13-year-old would have. Like,
that's totally fair.
Also, this 17-year-old is Steve. He's not supposed to be smart. He's dumb. That's right. His character.
Yeah. So, yeah, I believe, like, the best piece of advice that he could give him is the proper hairspray to use. Like, I buy that.
That was my favorite part of their whole conversation.
Oh, for sure. So cute.
Yeah, and he's insecure about it, too, Steve, about what brand of hair styling stuff he uses. and like, Dustin knows that he's not smart, too. Like, he invites him along because he's got the bat with the nails. And the way that the actor says the bat with the nails, like, obviously the bat with the nails. Oh, it's great. It's great. It's just, it's a great read. It's how the character would say that. Like, it's how Steve would react in that moment. Like, what are you talking about? It goes back into, like, these experiences should be all that these characters are talking about because they fought a creature from an alternate dimension. And Dustin's got a friend who can move shit with their mind. If everyone is agreeing to forget about this on different levels, like, I feel like it's still very much a part of Dustin's mind, but, like, Steve has to be reminded of it every so often because he's dumb. That's fantastic. That's just, it's just consistency that I really appreciate. And it's funny.
I just don't get the love for him from it.
I really enjoyed it.
Oh, it's so cute.
I even noted down, like, in a sarcastic way, am I supposed to like him now, or are we waiting until he saves the day again? Because I don't know. I thought there was going to be something more.
And to the show's credit, he doesn't even really do that. No, he doesn't save the day. He makes it worse, if anything.
Yeah, it's not over yet, Kissel. I mean,
he's going to save the day.
I didn't say that. We could be throwing you off.
Okay. Yeah, because we're so good at deception and not spoilers.
Someone else who could potentially play a big role in the final three episodes of the series, or I don't know, go away forever, is like I hope Steve Harrington does not do. I hope he has some role to play, but I feel like Brett Gelman, the conspiracy theorist, has kind of served his purpose. I again really enjoyed those scenes together. I talked about how much I like that actor, that comic actor, and I hoped that he got some fun eccentricities when he eventually showed up to play a larger part, and I think that is absolutely true. I think those scenes go a long way to making, again, the terrible teenage part of the show tolerable. If not tolerable, then almost good. The hole in this is that Nancy would be able to smuggle a 1980s-sized recording device into a top-secret government lab and come out with no problem after speaking to someone very high up in the organization and seeing the most top-secret of top-secret things. Whatever. That's a thing that happened. And I think that the way that they decide what to do about it is very true. I like the advice that Gelman gives them about this idea that if I can get on a nice little 19th century historical high horse here for a second, is very reminiscent of one of my favorite quotes from history spoken by an Italian revolutionary whose name I don't remember, in that freedom, in this case information, knowledge about what your government is doing, is like a giant horse, beautiful, elegant, strong, powerful. Some people want to ride it, most people are terrified of it. If they exposed the Hawkins lab for everything that they were doing, people would reject it out of hand just because they would need it to be false if they wanted to be good patriots like Mike's dad is, and they're right to water it down.
Yeah, I buy this character too. Like, there would be this guy that was kind of a leftover of the 60s and 70s thrown into this because, you know, it is in the 80s. So I liked him a lot, and I thought that this is the only way that they could have done the love triangle without me absolutely despising it, was to add this, like, very dynamic character into the middle of the whole thing.
Who explicitly says, this is stupid. You guys obviously like each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he was also a little too proud of teenagers fucking in his side bedroom.
Yeah. True. I feel like we didn't see the scene where he walked into that room and, like, inhaled
To be fair, he probably thought Jonathan was, like, 45.
Yes. If anything, he's an accessory after the fact.
Do you know how old that guy is in real life, though?
He's like Brian Gelman, isn't he?
No, Jonathan.
Yeah, like, oh, I don't know.
He's like 23 or 24.
Yeah. I mean.
And also, they're dating in real life, Nancy and Jonathan.
A lot of mileage on those 24 years, it seems.
I hated the whole Jonathan Nancy scene leading up to it all. It was annoying. I mean,
It did. It went on for way too long. Like,
I didn't think they were actually going to go for it when when they went to their separate rooms and then they came back out and kissed. I didn't think they were going to go for it.
It's a fake out of a fake out. I feel like once the show has explicitly stated that this is stupid,
the good old triple D,
you got to just go for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you said, like they're in their rooms thinking about it and they go out and run into each other and then they go back to their rooms and they go back out again. It took up a lot of time.
I didn't mind it. Whatever.
I enjoyed the teenage, both versions of the teenager story this week. Even as that was more for the characters that were surrounding them. I do think that the hookup was worth it, if only for Gelman asking Jonathan how the pullout was. I thought that was a strong, strong joke, because that's what happened. Let's be honest with ourselves. Nancy is very much at risk for a teen pregnancy now.
With a who's the father situation.
Yeah, Jonathan doesn't have great control over himself and maybe misjudged his timing.
That is all next season is. This show is going to change completely.
They're on Maury with the who's the father paternity situation.
I'm sure there's some 80s variety of that, of some kind of teenage pregnancy story.
Ricky Lake.
Sure, and that's happening in the background while the rest of the town is concerned about the encroaching rot that is causing a giant sinkhole, presumably.
Right, they go back to the lab for a DNA test, and they run back into all of our favorite characters. This is how Papa comes back.
There's a herd of Demogorgons, like, galloping past a window, and they're building a crib together, just totally oblivious to whatever's outside in the world. So, as mentioned,
it's gonna be great.
The Upside Down is spreading, and it's also psychically linked to Will. So, again, with just, like, the plot advancement and the plot density and complexity in these three episodes, like, this is a real moral conundrum. Like, if they continue to blow up all these vines, it's surely going to kill Will. But on the other hand, like, a dozen government agents, soldiers, whatever, were just murdered by said galloping tribe of Demogorgons.
Because they have the Horcrux link now.
It's great. I loved it. There was a sense of inevitability to it. It wasn't like sprung at the last moment. It was totally earned. Just great stuff. Good stuff. And whatever noise was coming out of Will and the weird facial expressions he was making at the end of the fifth episode, once it's discovered that he is, like, physically linked with all the vines and everything. Creepy. Really creepy.
So creepy. Yeah. Creepy.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that that's kind of a callback to The Exorcist, too, which is, you know, very similar, how you can almost see their personalities change going back and forth between possession and who they really are.
I feel like, I mean, we end the episode with the Demogorgons invading the lab. Whoever's left in the lab is going to go straight for Will and, like, murder him. Just because, like, that's a smart move at this point. If not, like, actually put a knife in his chest, they're still going to try and light up all the vines again. So I don't have any sense of what's going to happen. I mean, they have to, like, there's been nothing in the show so far to demonstrate how they could separate the Shadow Monster from Will. But at the same time, like, it's open warfare between the government and all this Upside Down stuff. So, I don't know. You hear through the ether certain things, and this show has been out for like 3 weeks now, that if Eleven eventually gets a standalone episode. I don't understand how they're going to pack that in with only three episodes left, but whatever. We'll find out next week and talk about it then. Anything else that we missed before we get into more, like, individual silly scenes and just low-level stuff happening in the background?
Is it even a possibility that one of the kids can die? Like, do we think that's a viable option for the show?
I mean, that big Will in the Quarry slow motion montage, whatever, from last season. I never bought that for a second.
You don't think that the show is capable of killing off a kid?
Because its most obvious homage was to Spielberg movies. And that kind of thing does not happen in Spielberg movies. Like E.T. rises from the dead. Main characters, or like fun supporting characters like Sala or whoever, they don't die in the Indiana Jones movies. Like the bad guys die and everything is more or less fine.
I feel like if the show plans to last a while, it has to happen. Even if it happens soon. I don't know.
Have y'all read somewhere, or maybe I don't remember where I read this, but I thought that they said they were only going to do 4 seasons was their top.
Oh, I haven't read anything about
it. But I don't remember where I read that or when I read that.
Hope they only do 4.
I feel like even that's aggressive. I'd be fine with only like 2 or 3.
Yeah.
I
mean,
there is the world expansion with that opening scene to the series that we talked about last week with the other. And we see another girl who may or may not be 8 with 11 in the mom's flashback, with little 11 in the mom's flashback. So I do think they're thinking about it. Like they can't stay in this town forever. It does. I don't have a sense of how long you stay with these kids.
They're just going to become teenagers and be like, I don't know.
Yes.
Not as interesting for a while.
Yeah. And then we follow Jonathan as he gets a mortgage because he's in his 30s. I did read that they want to film the 3rd and the 4th season like back to back, like Lord of the Rings movies, just to get a jump on the kids aging out. I feel like it's not a problem with any of them at this moment right now, but
I mean, they definitely did age, though. If you go back and compare, they definitely have changed a lot.
It only takes one of those boys hitting puberty. I mean,
Rand's eyebrows would like to have a word.
Right. Yeah.
Things, kids.
I mean, that's the thing. And then they're going to grow 9 inches and their voice is going to go down 3 octaves, but the other 4 aren't going to have done that. And it's just going to be bad for everyone involved.
To continue to venture out away from the fictional world of Stranger Things and into like the real world of it, the AV Club, just because they did the same thing with Game of Thrones. Whenever one of these extremely popular shows are on the air, they just put out news item after essay about whatever that show is, no matter how seemingly insignificant it might be. But with Stranger Things, a lot of the cultural talk has been around how disgusting people are about these kids. Like
the adults creeping them out and being pissed off that they won't talk to them?
Or like 11 or Millie Bobby Brown on the red carpet, like, 11 grew up before our eyes. Like, she's 13, dude. Be cool. And just like inappropriate fans in general and like Twitter talk and like models talking about how Mike should call her when he's 18. Yeah. Or Finn Wolfhard should call her. It's disgusting. It's disgusting. I don't feel like this happened with Game of Thrones. There was an equal amount of kid actors in that. Whatever.
It's too much all around. Let's just... Ugh.
Any more like plot stuff before we move on into frivolous nonsense?
Nah, because we're about to talk about that shower scene, and I can't wait to hear what you think about that.
So. Yeah, we see more basketball from Will and whatever. Billy. Not
Billy.
Will. Billy and Steve.
You got solid basketball coaching from Billy, right?
I feel like Billy lowered his shoulder, and at that point, I don't think it matters if your feet are moving anymore. I feel like in the war, like you've ref games before, Bobby.
Yeah, your feet can be moving; like you don't have to actually be standing still if you're in position.
Lowering the shoulder on offense is the universal symbol for a charge. And who's reffing these pickup PE games, anyways? So shut up, Billy. You don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Post PE scene, there is a shower scene. And I think Billy and Steve should just kiss already and get it over with. Because it's very homoerotic. They're standing right next to each other. There is contact between the two of them. And the terrible high school friend from the first season also makes a reappearance, which no one asked for.
Yeah, the freckle-faced kid.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. How much hair you think's in that drain after the two of them take a shower right next to each other?
It's clogged, that's for sure.
Somebody's got to get a snake in there. So much hair.
That felt like a vaguely sexual joke, and it made me uncomfortable.
It was, I mean, 30-somethings might be playing these high schoolers, but as far as the show is concerned, we are talking about wet, naked high schoolers wanting just obviously wanting to kiss each other in the shower.
Is it obvious?
I sure thought so. It's not unlike peeing next to someone. It's so inculcated in the culture that you leave that urinal space that it is an aggressive move to pee next to someone. Whereas I feel like the same idea applies to the shower.
No, Bobby, you don't have a choice in the shower. No, you're just a bunch of kids thrown into the locker room. You have to shower next to each other. You don't have a choice.
It was just Steve and Billy, though, in there.
Wasn't there a third one at first? And then
he came in later, didn't he?
It was a fairly empty room. They could have spread out.
Ashley, you rewound this scene 7 times and watched it.
I sure did.
Please give us the blow-by-blow as far as who entered and when, and at what moment, and at what second in the episode each of these scenes.
From what I remember from the one time I watched it, there were not many people in there.
That's a lie, but all right.
Who entered and when is also sounding very sexual.
Billy continues to make no sense as a character. He's just it's so lazy of the show to just make your standard racist into a generally terrible person, as if there aren't racists out there who don't think of themselves as good people. And for all intents and purposes, like from a person just watching their daily life, might very well look like a good person, except they have repulsive views. I mean, what is this? What are they building to with this guy? Just the level of the way that he threatens his stepsister, I feel like from frame one was always beyond just like sibling rivalry. Like it's malicious and malevolent. And like, what is this guy going to do? To talk about it again, there is a bully character in there who is escalated from your standard bully behavior. And I don't know, that character, I feel like, because there was a murderous clown like infecting people's minds, I didn't have a problem with that level of bullying. Like within the movie, it was horrifying in the movie itself. But this guy is, I just don't understand. And like he moved from the town of California to small town Indiana to be the most racist person in town. I don't know. That's weird.
Yeah, that seems unlikely.
Yeah, I feel like there was a nice fertile bed of racism. I mean,
not that he can't be racist coming from California, but yeah, he's going to fit in with a few of them.
Yeah, like you may as well have him be a collector of Nazi memorabilia. They can do better. We said we weren't going to just do nothing but praise this show in the opening, and like Billy is a constant source of frustration. What's going to be a source of frustration for Dustin's mom is how badly Walter Mondale is going to get spanked in the election by Ronald Reagan. I feel like it's one of the all-time great political disasters, like routes. And I don't know how Dustin's mom, being the Mondale fan that she is, and Mike's mom, being the Reagan fan that she is, are going to hash this out after. Like, how can Mike's mom not just gloat when Reagan wins like 49 out of 50 states in a week? I just feel bad for, like, poor Dustin's mom. I'm really monologuing here, but poor Dustin's mom, who...
She's had a rough week.
She lost her cat. She's going to be humiliated politically. Tough times for Dustin. But Dustin's hair is going to get a lot better shortly. So maybe it all shakes out.
I kind of hope we see it.
What do you think?
I kind of see him hairspray.
I think I don't want to interrupt that monologue. It was just, you were on a roll. I don't want to get into
it. It's very,
that.
Like, they take the time to find the signs in the yards of these two people. And I feel like we come in on the tail end of a conversation between the two of them, too. So, like, they're living in their own drama series, the mom characters.
Like, the Real Housewives of Hawkins.
Yeah, they're just chatting about whatever the hot political issues were in 1984, probably Morning in America or some shit, whereas Mondale thought it was Afternoon at Best.
I would watch that spinoff, Real Housewives.
Absolutely.
Hawkins.
It's just, yeah. It's just the psychiatrist from Mad Men and the security guard from Orange is the New Black sitting on a couch watching political debates. The last thing that I want to talk about. It's well established that Paul Reiser is a doctor in the show. Not only a doctor, but like a doctor among doctors. Like he's leading these people in whatever it is that they're working on. He calls viruses alive. They are not. And that is like day one biology 100 type stuff.
I feel another monologue coming on.
He then calls them intelligent, which if they're not alive, and again, viruses are not alive. They are not living things. They're certainly not intelligent.
Is this like again, something they knew back in 1984? I don't know.
100%. 100% right. They knew back in 1984, yes. Viruses are just...
good enough for me.
A protein shell with a strand of DNA inside. They do not eat. They do not consume. They move around in the sense that they are trying to bump into something that they can't that the proteins on their body are attracted to. They are not alive. In no way are they alive. And I don't know. That was just stupid. There's just a better way to describe what was going on in Mike's head. Like, they knew about parasites and the various mind control parasites that exist in the world in the 80s, probably. I'm going to go and put my nickel down and say that they absolutely knew about those. For example, there is a there's like a protozoa that gets into the head of an ant that causes the ant to hang out on the edges of on the edges of blades of grass, making them more visible to predators, which then eat the ant, which then gets the protozoa inside the predator, which allows it to continue its life cycle. That's well established, like nature type stuff.
And that's your MMC science moment.
Viruses aren't alive. It just makes the show stupid. It's like they put no research into a biological comparison, just like they put no research into what people like to do in Indiana. It speaks to the level of laziness in a certain part of Stranger Things. But whatever. This isn't a conversation that happened in an 80s movie, so it escaped their knowledge.
I don't know what people like to do in Indiana, and I'm from Indiana. So
you're from Carmel.
Which is in Indiana.
Carmel is in Indiana in the sense that some metaphor that I can't think of right now.
A puddle, something to do with a puddle, I'm sure.
Oh, damn it. Fuck, I need Megan's quick on the fly Googling and or quick brain.
I wish you would all fuck right off is what I wish.
That'll get it out. Anything else on these three episodes?
Am I the only one, or was Winona's acting the worst of the series so far for her?
I've never liked her in this show.
But it felt distracting in a couple times. Like when she's talking to Bob and the whole house before they start doing the map thing. And then...
like when she's trying to get him to leave?
Yeah, that, and then in the house. I don't know. She just seemed overdone, like the whole thing. I don't know.
She's overacting it now.
Yeah, she is overacting everything.
Whereas the overacting last year, you could kind of push it to the side because, yeah, like her a kid woman would missing. Be frantic when her kid's missing. But now it's like, it does. You feel it, I think, a little bit more this season than you did last season. Or at least I do.
I mean, she's genuinely getting shown up by half a dozen kids.
I think she got shown up by the actress that was playing Eleven's mom.
Absolutely.
In the montage, it was more invested.
I thought you meant
when she was invested.
Sitting in the chair.
I kind of do mean that. Like, it was to see just her absolute panic.
But that was also told.
Her baby stolen from her.
That was absolutely told and shot a lot better than anything we got.
100% agree. And
Winona Ryder though does not age at all. Like she feels like she's aging in reverse.
I think the best acting that Winona Ryder has done in relation to Stranger Things is the facial expression she made during David Harbour's acceptance speech during the SAG Awards last year. Where it's just like a string of like contortions and Jim Carrey face.
Winona Ryder feels
really impressive. And really, if I was David Harbour, I would be pissed off because she totally pulls focus when he's like pouring his heart out in front of everyone. And all anyone can talk about is was how many strokes did Winona Ryder give
him? True. I like that we're getting more Bob. I like Bob so much.
I like Bob. I like Bob.
Yeah, Bob was much better. He brought me around these episodes.
It would have been nice if Will like told him your advice was terrible. Like your advice got me shadow molested. But whatever. Maybe he doesn't remember specifics. Yeah, Bob's great. I like that he had a moment. And I don't have a problem with how quick he arrived at his conclusion. Like, he was just in the room and then immediately, like...
No, he bobbed the brain.
I don't have any problem with it. None at all. Made nothing but good things happen to him. I mean, if there was a character that I had to wager would get blown up or eaten or whatever, it's Bob. He's just... I do still think it's the kind of show where one of the kids can die or even one of the teenagers, but if you go further down the list from there, Bob is the highest on said list. Like, who cares if Paul Reiser dies? Oh, that would be a level of investment equivalent to, like, the Tillman Drive woman dying last year. Like, it just wasn't, it wasn't a big deal.
We might see Billy eaten.
Billy. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he but he's the mustache-twirling villain. Hillbilly villain. I expect that to happen just because that character cannot be around. They're building to something, I feel like they're building to something really awful with him. Like, he's going to do something evil. I guess it's good acting just because he's so hateful. But what is he doing in this show? It's a weird choice. It doesn't fit. Anyways.
No, he's fine as hell in real life, though. That's for sure.
I told you. You did a little Googling, didn't you?
So other siblings in the show, Erica, Lucas's sister, kind of cracks me up.
Yeah, she's good.
Her love scene with He-Man and Barbie was better than Nancy and
Jonathan.
I feel like we're one or two degrees away from putting her into that zone where she's like the way too smart younger sibling that is like giving her older sibling advice about stuff that younger sibling doesn't know anything about, a la like 500 Days of Summer. Or, there are many examples.
I hate that.
I don't think we're there.
No, I hate when little kids act like adults. It's annoying.
Yeah.
No, but right now she just plays with dolls and tells them to shut up.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I like her now. I just hope like that 500 Days of Summer character is infuriating. Like,
yeah, it drags the movie down.
I just think the one thing that they do so well in this show, like better than any other show I've seen, is the relationship between parents and children in the 80s. And like the familial dynamics of these families in suburban areas in the 80s, like the fact that your kid could be gone for like, how long has Mike been gone without his parents really?
It's been like, some time.
Realizing it? I don't know. And there's a line that I won't say because I'm 100% positive it's in a later episode, but Mike's dad has a line in this season that it's just so like, I don't know. They're oblivious to what's going on with their children is my favorite thing in the entire world.
My kids don't live here anymore.
Oh, no. That's already happened?
It did.
Okay, yeah. Like, none of our kids live here.
God, Megan, like, you even said you were 100% sure. How embarrassing.
This is why you aren't in the club.
You really should have used those Google skills again.
God, just 98%. And, like, I would have given that to you, but you said 100.
I really wish I just hadn't answered the phone tonight.
If you want to hear Megan continue to be just humiliated by us and by herself as well, tune in next week when we talk about the final three episodes of Stranger Things. I don't know what they're entitled, but we're going to – I feel like the main controversy in this season, like critical controversy, has been the standalone 11 episode. I'm excited to see how that goes.
I've got real original opinions about that one, guys.
Fantastic. We'll be back, to talk about Megan's fantastic analogies and how they relate to Eleven being out on her own doing something. I don't know what. In the meantime, check us out on the internet at MediaCanMovie.club. Last night, I posted a review for Mo Better Blues, Spike Lee's somewhat disappointing follow-up to his masterpiece, Do the Right Thing. Coming up next, we've got The Pelican Brief, available on Hulu, starring Denzel Washington, Julia Roberts. Like us on Facebook at Media Can Movie Club. Follow us on Twitter at Media Can Movie Club. iTunes reviews, Amazon link, all that good stuff. One helps us reach more people, and the other one helps us keep the lights on. Excited to see how the season ends. I'm looking forward to it in a way. Like, there's the compulsive, like, Netflix. I want to know what happens next, just because they are so aggressive with the episode ending cliffhangers. And there's just, like, I'm genuinely concerned about what happens to these characters. And that's where I'm at, which is a much better place to be in going into these final three episodes. And I'm excited to talk about it. But that's in a week. At this moment right now, Thank you for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Thanks, John.
Have a good night.